The Guardian.
This podcast is sponsored by audible.co.uk, the number one online destination for digital audiobooks.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Claire Armistead.
Hello, I'm Neil Gaiman, and this week I've taken over the Guardian Books Podcast. We'll be talking about what the future holds for writers and readers alike with Cory Doctorow, Johnny Geller, and Henry Volans. We'll also be journeying to the banks of the Thames with a live reading of my short story, Down to a Sunless Sea, and exploring the roots of weird London with Damien Walter.
Hello, I'm Damien Walter, columnist for The Guardian and massive fan of all things weird. Today I'm on a tour of weird London itself and the many locations in this city which have been featured in fantasy fiction, from novels like Susanna Clarke's Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell through to authors like China Mieville and books like Un-London and Perdido Street Station, which recast London in Baroque, Gothic and weird ways. I've come off from Oxford Street into one of the winding back streets of London, Hanway Place itself, and it's a rather mundane, even down-at-heel location, featured in none other than Neil Gaiman's Neverwhere. This is where the young Richard Mayhew finds the mysterious Orme Passage and is drawn into the world beneath London, a world where characters and places are named after tube stations, and the entire city is recast into a fantasy world.
Can you undo these manacles?
Yes, of course. Richard. Oh. Richard?
Hundreds of people in this other London.
Richard!
London below.
Oh, Temple and
thousands,
Arch, is he
maybe.
Dead?
People who come from here, or people who have fallen through the cracks in my reality.
What was that?
I found an injured girl bleeding on the pavement, and I tried to be a good Samaritan. Now, I've got no fiancé, no home, no job, and I am walking around a couple of hundred feet under the streets of London with the life expectancy of a suicidal Mayfair.
Richard! I know every Stop inch of the underside.
Me. He's not yours.
I'll be the judge of that.
Neverwhere, by Neil Gaiman.
I'm here to meet Tom Pollock, author of The City's Sun, a fantastic debut fantasy novel which has been inspired both by the sights and sounds of London and by the writing of Neil Gaiman and Neverwhere itself. How do you find Hanway Place as a location?
It's sort of narrow and crooked, it's a bit dingy, it feels realer than a lot of the places around here. The big thing for me was actually the Neverwhere TV series, which aired when I was about 12, I think. All the fantasy I'd read up to that point was epic fantasy. It was sort of Tolkien and his descendants, stories about people crossing giant mountain ranges and going into deep forests in order to dispose of malign jewellery in a way that would be immortalised in song. And Neverwhere, when I watched it, was this complete bolt out of the blue because it was the exact opposite of that. It was obsessed with the secret and the local. It was this sensation that there was weird things that could be 10 or 15 feet from you and you don't know they're there. It's much more threatening that way as well, because this is a fantasy that knows where you live.
We've got a really large number of books reimagining, fantasizing about London at the moment. Why London specifically?
So London was never built to a plan. Unlike Paris, it's not built on a grid, unlike most American cities. The sight lines are very obscured. The streets wind. There's a lot of places that you know are very close to you that you can't see into. Little hidden boxes of space which could be concealing anything.
There's something about the nature of fantasy which is, of course, escapist.
Yeah.
Stepping out of our lives, finding another world, another life to go into. If Orme Passage opened up before you now, would you step into it?
I would, but I would be shitting myself.
Yeah. And even the world of Neverwhere itself. Mm. They're led down from Hanway Place down into the under London world. They meet the rat speakers. Yeah. And then they're led from there across and out into the British Museum. And that's where we're going to be heading next on our tour of London.
Oh, That's an interesting thing that people don't talk much about Neverwhere is the fact that, Richard Mayhew is an outsider to the city. Most of the London Gothic novels that you get nowadays are all about natives who discover this stuff as it's been under their nose all along.
Now we're at the British Museum. This is where Richard Mayhew and Dore come as part of their adventures in Neverwhere. They come up into Bloomsbury through the abandoned British Museum tube station, which hasn't been in use for decades at the time. And they come here to the Early English Room, which unfortunately the managers at the museum now have to disappoint dozens of visitors who come to see it because it is entirely fictional. Many great artists and writers have been drawn to the reading room at the museum here. Among them, some of the early members of the Order of the Golden Dawn, the greatest occult order ever to form in the city of London, including Alistair the Great Beast Crowley. Across the road from the British Museum is the Atlantis Bookshop, the oldest occult bookshop in the world, and they'll be meeting Geraldine Breskin. Hello, Geraldine.
Oh, hello there. Nice to meet you.
Daniel,
how are you
Walter.
Doing? Good. He's excited about this.
Let's head downstairs then. Good. And ask you some questions over some tea.
Yeah, the kettle's on. Come on down. Occult London started in a big way in 1875 when a Russian woman, Madame Blavatsky, who was again a world traveller, set up the Theosophical Society. It was the first non-Christian society that men and women could join. That was what was radical about it. And she also had the charisma to get away with telling people what she did, which was utterly fantastical in lots and lots of ways. And then a few years after that, they decided that they wanted more than the passivity of being mystical about things, that there were translations going on over in Paris of medieval manuscripts. There was endless stuff in the British Library that they were finding at the top of the street here. And so they decided that they wanted to do magic. And that's when the Golden Dawn started. And again, the first person who was properly initiated into that was Mina Mathers. Mm. She was a student at the Slade. She married a man who she said she would never marry. She just saw him and just had this, you know, fantasy for him. They did marry very successfully in magical terms. And it went on from there, really. Mm. Now, within, I think it was about 5 or 6 years, they had 300-odd people in it. There's lots of magical organisations nowadays that don't have that many people in them.
Of course, it was a massive phenomenon around London.
It was remarkable. And it was also, the creative artistic intelligentsia who were attracted to it. And it was a very, very, very radical thing to do, to actually stand there in drawing rooms and conjure demons and spirits and to believe that the world ran on a whole different set of rules. Mm. It's still considered quite transgressive in a way to become interested in the esoteric, in a positive, Western magical way. And that's kind of the line in the sand, as I've often said, that the mystics are seekers, the magicians are finders.
Mm. Can I ask you then, for people like W.B. Yeats, yep, who I know is involved, MacGregor Mathers. Did they believe in it wholeheartedly? Did they believe in their magic, or was it theatrics to them?
They started off trying to see if it worked, because they were working with sometimes incomplete medieval manuscripts. They had to construct the rituals themselves. Because they were masons, they had a structure to work with, and they had an outer order and an inner order. And they, through experimentation, It worked. The book said, if you do this and you conjure this critter by this name, its function is such and such. Mm. So they then developed a whole very sensual system using colour and number and texture and smell and this table of correspondences, as they call it, where what you were doing, everything suggested your aim. And somebody else who was in it, who was a classic asthmatic genius, Alan Bennett, Bennett and Crowley decided to hang it all on the Jewish Kabbalistic Tree of Life, because that gives you a structure, it gives you a clear shape. It has 10 circles, progressing, and there are paths linking those, so you can work any which way around up the tree, mm-hmm. basically. And they were the people who put those attributions onto each of those circles, onto the Sephiroth.
Mm. Does the shop here still act as a magnet for occult London?
Oh, yes. Yeah. I mean, we're very proud of our history, but we're very proud of our present as well. And we're quite hardcore about magic, really. We're not New Age. We're not fluffy. We don't indulge... You know, there's a lot of cynical publishing and things that are done as product, and they have cheapened angels. There's a big move now to create... The next wave is meant to be unicorns. Well, they've been hacking at that for the last 5 years to no bloody success, happily. These things shouldn't be corrupted. They shouldn't be corrupted. Mm. But you need very simple tools. You know, my old mum used to say, you just need an index finger. She said, all these people who have all their razzmatazz and temples set up and velvet cloaks and, you know, lots of incense and all the rest of it. She said, come the moment, all you need is to point and go kind of idea. You just need to push it out through your index finger. That's your one, and push it out there. And then the magic happens.
So here in the Atlantis bookshop itself, amongst one of the most amazing collections of occult and mystical books in the country, or possibly even the world, we've been joined by M. John Harrison, who has featured the Atlantis bookshop in one of his novels, The Course of the Heart.
Rain dripped from the blue and gold front of the Atlantis. There was a faded notice, closed for complete refurbishment. The window display had been taken down, but for the look of things, they had left a few books on a shelf. Inside, the shop smelt of cut timber, new plaster, paint, but this gave way on the stairs to an odour of cooking. Yaxley fumbled with his key. His bedsitter, which was quite large and on the top floor, had uncurtained sash windows on opposing walls. Nevertheless, it didn't seem well lit. From one window, you could see the sodden facades of Museum Street, bright green deposits on the ledges, stucco scrolls and garlands grey with pigeon dung, and out of the other, part of the blackened clock tower of St. George's Bloomsbury. I once heard that clock strike 21, said Yaxley. He was silent for a minute, and then he laughed. I'm not going to help you, he said. You know that. I wouldn't be allowed to. What you do in the Pleroma is irretrievable. He fished two cups out of a plastic washing-up bowl, and he put the tea bags in them. Don't tell me you're frightened, too, he said. I expected more from you. I shook my head. I wasn't sure whether I was afraid or not. The tea, when it came, had a distinctly greasy aftertaste, as if somehow he had fried it. I made myself drink it while he watched me cynically. You ought to sit down, he said. You're worn out. Nobody tricked you or tried to pretend it would be easy. If you get anything out of an experiment like that, it's by keeping your head and taking your chance. If you try to move cautiously, you may never be allowed to move at all. He looked thoughtful. I've seen what happens to people who lose their nerve, he said. I'm sure, I said. They were hardly recognisable, some of them. I put the teacup down. I don't want to know, I said. I bet you don't. He smiled to himself. Oh, they were still alive, if that's what you're worried about. You talked me into this, I reminded him. You talked yourself into it. You'll get sick of all this mess one day, I said from the door of the bedsit. He grinned and he nodded and he advised me. Have you ever seen Joan of Arc get down to pray in the ticket office at St. Pancras Station, and then a small boy comes in leading something that looks like a goat, and it gets on her there and then and fucks her in a ray of sunlight? Come back when you know what you want. Get rid of those other people. They're amateurs.
Mike, could you just tell us a bit about what's thrown these characters together in the story?
They have made, at some point prior to the opening of the story, an experiment while they were at college in the occult. They have been led by the man Yaxley, who has promised them nothing and who has in fact left them with, shall we say, a haunting. The haunting is, in fact, their only memory of the event itself. And the book never tells you what the event was. It never describes the experiment, and it never explains anything. It's about the fact that your actions after a traumatic event are your memory. They are the memory. They are an active memory of the thing that happened. But, of course, all shifted into an occult background and an occult rationale.
St. George's Church in Bloomsbury, designed by Nicholas Hawksmoor, one of the famous Hawksmoor churches, which are spaced around London and have been written about by a number of writers, including Peter Ackroyd and Alan Moore, as part of a huge historic occult ritual that was also tied up with the Jack the Ripper murders in London. What is it about London, locations like this, that makes us want to turn it into fantasy?
I think your classic psychogeographical answer to that would be, as it were, weight of history, weight of lives, violence and misery. Mm. It's always, for me, to do with the earthing out of some kind of tension, personal tension, between the inside of me and the landscape. I don't regard urban landscapes to be any less landscapes than hills or mountains. I think that the weird is any collision of every possible form of the fantastic. The other thing about the weird is it's got a lot more feeling than most of the other genres. Mm. It can't be solved like a puzzle. It doesn't have that cognitive rationale to it. It doesn't have a self-consistent story arc or any of that nonsense. It's about feelings. Its logic is the logic of feeling. It's a bit like its logic is the logic of images, of poetry. It's a big, nice big space to work in, the weird, if it exists.
Damien Walter and friends exploring weirdness in London. I'm delighted by that description of the weird as any collision of any form of the fantastic. It's a description that might go for Neil Gaiman, whose output has been notable not just in the range of subject matter, but also in its breadth of media. Comics, radio plays, journalism, short stories and novels, and of course Doctor Who. At the recent London Book Festival, he went so far as to argue that all writers have to expand their skills in such a way to cover all this media. I'm Claire Armistead, and joining me in the studio to discuss this and other matters are the agent Johnny Geller, writer and provocateur Corey Doctorow, and Henry Volans, head of digital at publisher Faber. Corey, one idea that Gaiman cited in his book Fair Provocation, he admitted he'd stolen from you, and it was the idea of dandelion careers for writers.
Yeah, I guess the starting point for me is that regardless of whether you do what I do with my novels, which is to make them available as shareable downloads at the same time as they're available as books you can buy, every book that is published is available as a free download, right? The number of clicks it takes to download a book for free through one of the pirate sites is about the same number of clicks as it takes to download the book for money from one of the legitimate sites. And what that means is that every transaction is fundamentally a voluntary one. I mean, whether or not you like it, we are somewhat saved by the fact that our distribution costs nothing these days, that books can be downloaded and passed around with no cost to the writer. And it kind of begs us to approach our careers in different ways. And so I came up with this metaphor of thinking like a dandelion. A dandelion sprays a couple thousand seeds in the air every spring, and it doesn't care that every seed lands somewhere that's fertile. What it cares about is that every crack in the pavement has dandelions growing in it. And as a writer, I'm not so much interested that everybody who reads my work pays me for it. I'm much more interested in seeing to it that everybody willing to pay gets a chance to read my work.
Johnny, you presumably wouldn't be very happy to see your writers drifting like chaff onto the pavements of London.
Yeah, no, it's sort of the opposite model that we normally have, which is to try and focus and filter and get the right, well, the best books out there to the people who want them. I mean, it does slightly remind me of the old publishing model, which was throw as many projects at the wall and see what sticks. And we have been fighting against that trend of big publishers. But I think I understand what Corey and what Neil Gaiman's saying, which is, actually, there's so many opportunities, endless possibilities now of what to do with your book. It's only part of the story. People still want books. They still want them distributed in certain ways. It's not simply just downloads.
One of the issues that has occurred to me in my sleepless nights over these issues is that it's you and me it's going to put out of business. Actually, literature will go on happening. The establishments around it are very threatened by this, aren't they?
Yes, but I think so what? I mean, you know, an establishment changes then and shifts, and the establishments that don't shift deserve to die, to be honest. I think that a revolution has got to do that, and the good people, the people who believe in it and who are flexible and agile, will survive. I'm not worried about that.
What about traditional writers, very good writers in the middle of their careers? What's it going to do for them? They're not necessarily going to want to start embracing all the media, Twitter, all the social networks.
Well, this is where I think roles like an agency or a publisher have changed and will change, because they will start helping them do that. That's one part of the service they will provide. An author, look, some authors are very good at communication, at online marketing and all the other kind of things, and some simply aren't, and they just want to carry on writing. Some don't want to worry about Lithuanian rights in the middle of the night, you know, and distribution problems in Spain. So there are always going to be, hopefully, professionals on their side to help them do that.
And you could be someone who a writer hires rather than writers being people that you take on as an agent.
Well, I think publishing services might be part of it, but I think it's more of a management role rather than an agent role. I think that's changed. It's now about looking after the whole life of a book and an author.
Corey, you formulated something called Doctorow's Law, which was any time someone puts a lock on something you own against your wishes and doesn't give you the key, they're not doing it for your benefit. Tell us what you mean. Who on earth could you mean by that?
There's two parties to whom Doctorow's Law applies. The first is publishers, as befits their relationship with distributors and retailers. So I think a lot of publishers assume that the reason that Amazon has put DRM on their ebooks or Apple
Explain what DRM is.
I beg your pardon. Digital rights management is that stuff that when you try to get your computer to do something, it sort of says, no, I can't let you do that, Dave. So you try to skip an advert on your DVD and it says, no, not allowed. Or you try to move your Kindle book onto an iPad and it says, not allowed. And digital rights management enjoys a curious legal protection under something called the EUCD, the European Copyright Directive, which is that it's against the law to break DRM even if you're not breaking the law in any other way. So it's against the law to remove a lock from something even if you don't do anything wrong after you remove the lock. And so what that means is that publishers assume that the reason Apple and Amazon have put this on is to protect their interests. But what they find is that when they go to Amazon, they say, you know what? We would like our customers very much to be able to move their books from Kindles onto your competitor's hardware. Could you please, since you're the only ones who are legally allowed to authorize them to unlock their books and move them to a competing platform, could you please do that? Amazon's answer is an unequivocal no, as is Apple's, as is Google's, as is everybody else who uses DRM. Because the point of DRM is to lock customers into the retailer.
Now, there's some wry smiles going on the other side of the table. Henry, you're presumably quite keen on your locks at Faber.
I've got no love for them. Consumers don't know the term DRM or what it is. They only know or should be expected to know its effects. And I think it's more important to think in terms of what can or cannot a user do with something they have bought. What frustrates readers? Are they frustrated that they can't share an ebook they have with their husband and wife, and then address that and look at it from the point of view of usability?
So I spent, for my sins, half a decade in DRM standards bodies. And do you know what happens when you try to make a DRM that can accommodate, for example, sharing within a family? You have a bunch of technocrats, essentially white guys in suits from technology companies, who define what is and isn't a family. And I'll give you some of the examples that all of the DRMs that try to accommodate families can't accommodate. They can accommodate a family that owns a second home, but they can't accommodate a family where dad and mom live in the Philippines, and one daughter is working as a domestic in the UK, and one son is working as a construction worker in Saudi Arabia. That family doesn't exist in any of the DRM family models.
My take on this is a lot will be resolved by and in the market, and the publisher and author and retailer who are best able to get readers what they want, shareability, usability, accessibility, price, etc., in an ebook will win out. And I think these things, there's a competitive point to it.
But there just seems to be two visions here. One is of a world where we are filtering the reader experience, and the other where it's completely unfiltered and uninhibited. Publishing ultimately doesn't give what the readers want because they have hardbacks, and then you have to wait for paperbacks, and then you have ebooks with DRM or not. You know, it's a continual game that, or a dance, shall we say, between a publisher stroke author and the reader and how to get them to pay more money. And on the other hand, if you have everything should be accessible and everything available for whatever price, I don't see how that model can ever really cultivate new writing, invest in the business. For me, whose primary responsibility is for authors, I'm continually trying to find new sources of income for them with the least amount of effort, because I want them to carry on writing, because that's the point. That's what they want to do.
How about the creative content? Corey, what's it done for actually
the form?
Well,
I think we haven't seen it. No one has made an ebook yet that has been very successful, where if you take the E out, it ceases to be useful as a book. And of course, ebooks have lots of properties that are not available to books. They can be dynamically updated. They can be one character long. They can be 1 million pages long. I mean, Wikipedia might be arguably the first properly successful ebook in that it's a form that can only exist electronically. Even if you make a single copy of Wikipedia, you know, slurp it down and stick it on a memory stick, it's not Wikipedia. It's only Wikipedia if it's live. Part of Wikipedia is that it's a dialectic. It's a process. And so if you can't see and dispute and edit, its mechanism for failing well is left off.
But that's my vision of hell. The idea that a book can have loads of people interfering with it. I'm not against new forms, but fundamentally, the experience of reading is not about having lots of different input from without the author.
Unlike the previous subject, I'm completely with Corey on this, in the sense that ebooks as they stand in the main are in surprisingly incredibly conservative form. But there will be and has to be a new type of book written which takes far more advantages of the opportunities
Why?
Of the new form.
Why does that
have to
be
a new book?
Because
one of the best reasons is the authors want it. It's come up on a previous podcast here, but Ian Pearce's new novel, before he even approached publishers, he commissioned a software developer to write a web-based authoring tool for him to write his novel in a series of episodes or vignettes, which designed, it has a wiki-style editing function in that at the moment's opened up to his editors, but has the potential to open up much further.
That's an interesting model, but a bit like when J.K. Rowling with Pottermore has added stuff in, new material after it was a big event, after everyone had a relationship with her world. To go and have relationships with a world you don't know about is a very big leap. I'm not saying, by the way, that ebooks can't explore new things.
I think Corey and I probably both feel it's not yet here. The success hasn't arrived.
I want to point out that the kind of eternal storytelling mode in which the stories are bound between pages and they have identified authors who claim authorship over them is a tiny blip in the history of storytelling, most of which has consisted of storytelling that had no authorship, where each storyteller retold it, where you were expected to interfere with the narrative and interpret it, and then in fact, you know, just as human beings are a short-lived and as yet unsuccessful experiment in the history of the Earth, and we've had a tiny moment relative to, say, the dinosaurs or the single-celled organisms, by the same token, stories trapped between covers are a flashing instant in the history of narrative.
I agree 100% with what you just said, but as we don't know what the next thing is, this conversation can't really go anywhere because all you can do is experiment. Faber can invest in apps and different directions. Mm. You can experiment with fiction, and I'm going to try and work out what sells.
But I'd also say in terms of formats and different media with which you introduced this slot, a good example is an eminent British film director who delivered his book to us solely as film, as video. clips from films and him talking to camera, and there, that's a something that can only exist in that new way. We can transcribe it into a book, but we can also make a digital book with the clips contained. One of Johnny's authors, John Le Carré, in his biog, says proudly and brilliantly, for the past 50 years, he has lived by his pen. And that's a great statement. And I would want as many authors as possible for that to be true of. But we know it's not true for everyone. So where we publish a singer, a pop musician, we can now, as for Beck, put on a concert at the Barbican. And under our Faber Social imprint, that's what we're doing. So the breadth of what a publisher can do is growing massively.
Well, thanks to all three of you. Thanks also to Neil for spending a day with us on the book site, as well as curating this podcast. We'll end with Neil reading his own short story, Down to a Sunless Sea. In the meantime, from me, Claire Armistead, and producer Tim Mabey, goodbye.
The Thames is a filthy beast. It winds through London like a snake or a sea serpent. All the rivers flow into it, the Fleet and the Tyburn and the Neckinger, carrying all the filth and scum and waste, the bodies of cats and dogs and the bones of sheep and pigs down into the brown water of the Thames, which carries them east into the estuary and from there into the North Sea and oblivion. It is raining in London. The rain washes the dirt into the gutters and it swells streams into rivers, rivers into powerful things. The rain is a noisy thing, splashing and pattering and rattling the rooftops. If there's clean water as it falls from the skies, it only needs to touch London to become dirt, to stir dust and make it mud. Nobody drinks it. Neither the rainwater nor the river water. They make jokes about Thames water killing you instantly. And it is not true. There are mudlarks who will dive deep for thrown pennies, then come up again, spout the river water, shiver and hold up their coins. They do not die, of course. Well, not of that. Although there are no mudlarks over 15 years of age. The woman does not appear to care about the rain. She walks the Rotherhithe docks as she has done for years, for decades. Nobody knows how many years because nobody cares. She walks the docks or she stares out to sea. She examines the ships as they bob at anchor. She must do something to keep body and soul from dissolving their partnership, but none of the folk of the dock have the foggiest idea what this could be. You take refuge from the deluge, beneath a canvas awning put up by a sailmaker. You believe yourself to be alone under there at first, for she is statue still and staring out across the water, even though there is nothing to be seen through the curtain of rain. The far side of the Thames has vanished. And then she sees you. She sees you and she begins to talk, not to you, oh no, but to the grey water that falls from the grey sky into the grey river. She says, "My son wanted to be a sailor," and you do not know what to reply or how to reply. You would have to shout to make yourself heard over the roar of the rain, but she talks and you listen. You discover yourself craning and straining to catch her words. "My son wanted to be a sailor. I told him not to go to sea. 'I'm your mother,' I said. 'The sea won't love you like I love you. She's cruel.' But he said, 'Oh, mother, I need to see the world. I need to see the sun rise in the tropics and watch the northern lights dance in the Arctic sky. And most of all, I need to make my fortune. And then when it's made, I will come back to you and build you a house and you will have servants and we will dance, mother. Oh, how we will dance.' 'And what would I do in a fancy house?' I told him. 'You're a fool with your fine talk.' I told him of his father who never came back from the sea. Some said he was dead and lost overboard, while some swore blind they'd seen him running a whorehouse in Amsterdam. It's all the same. The sea took him. When he was 12 years old, my boy ran away down to the docks and he shipped on the first ship he found to Flores in the Azores, they told me. There's ships of ill omen, bad ships. They give them a lick of paint after each disaster and a new name to fool the unwary. Sailors are superstitious. The word gets around. This ship was run aground by its captain on orders of the owners to defraud the insurers. And then, all mended and as good as new, it gets taken by pirates. And then it takes shipments of blankets and becomes a plague ship, crewed by the dead, and only three men bring it to port in Harwich. My son had shipped on a Stormcrow ship. It was on the homeward leg of the journey, with him bringing me his wages, for he was too young to have spent them on women and on grog, like his father, that the storm hit. He was the smallest one in the lifeboat. They said they drew lots fairly, but I do not believe it. He was smaller than them. After 8 days adrift in the boat, they were so hungry. And if they did draw lots, they cheated. They gnawed his bones clean one by one, and they gave him to his new mother, the sea. She shed no tears and took them without a word. She's cruel. Some nights I wish he had not told me the truth. He could have lied. They gave my boy's bones to the sea, but the ship's mate, who had known my husband and known me too, better than my husband thought he did if truth were told. He kept a bone as a keepsake. When they got back to land, all of them swearing my boy was lost in the storm that sank the ship. He came in the night and he told me the truth of it, and he gave me the bone for the love there had once been between us. I said, "You've done a bad thing, Jack. That was your son that you've eaten." The sea took him too that night. He walked into her with his pockets filled with stones, and he kept walking. He'd never learned to swim. And I put the bone on a chain to remember them both by, late at night when the wind crashes the ocean waves and tumbles them onto the sand, when the wind howls around the houses like a baby crying. The rain is easing, and you think she is done, but now, for the first time, she looks at you and appears to be about to say something. She has pulled something from around her neck, and now she's reaching it out to you. "Here," she says. Her eyes, when they meet yours, are as brown as the Thames. "Would you like to touch it?" You want to pull it from her neck, to toss it into the river for the mudlarks to find or to lose. But instead you stumble out from under the canvas awning, and the water of the rain runs down your face like someone else's tears.
Visit audible.co.uk/guardianaudio to choose from a selection of over 60,000 titles. With Audible, you can make more time for books by downloading and listening wherever you are and whatever you're doing.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.